You're listening to the Party in My Plants podcast, and you're about to hear how the cutest couple of cooks I know went from a diet full of microwaving Hot Pockets to a life fulfilled by homemaking hot pizza, and in the process, realized that cooking with one's other half can actually be double the fun. Welcome to the Party in My Plants podcast, where I make healthy living as fun as a party so you'll, you know, actually want to do it and then actually feel, look, and live your best. I'm your host, Talia Pollock. Now let's get this party started. This episode is enthusiastically sponsored by a product that couldn't possibly float my boat more, Four Sigmatic. My boat is so floated by Four Sigmatic's mushroom drinks that any more floating would turn my boat into an airplane because it's flying. Okay, so the first time I tried a packet of Four Sigmatic mushroom tea and a glass of hot water, I was muy skeptical because of this whole mushroom thing being really trendy right now, and I'm always reluctant to hop on trend trains. Wow, we're really covering all the modes of transportation here. But I drank those shrooms and I felt truly awesome. It's hard to explain. I just felt way more awesome than I felt before I drank it. Since then, I consistently consume at least one type of shrooms a day, and it helps me know it's going to be bright, 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 sunshiny day, even when it's rainy and gray, because I am telling you these mushrooms are magic. Although they don't make me hallucinate in a bathtub like my ex-boyfriend's famous magic mushroom experience, which in hindsight, he seemed way too proud of. But nobody's hallucinating the magical effects of these shrooms, okay? They are ultra scientifically proven to boost immunity and gut health. Yes, please and thank you. And the four different shrooms that Four Sigmatic uses most, hence the four in Four Sigmatic. Wink, wink. They all do different epic things for your bod. Reishi helps you relax. Cordyceps give you a non-caffeinated energy for sports and stuff. Lion's mane, which does not come from a lion's mane, boosts your brain. And chaga is a mega charge for your immune system. I weave all four of those separate mushrooms into my life by way of the teas. That's what I'm talking about here, people, are mushroom teas that you dissolve in a packet of hot water and hiya. But I also fancy myself some of their fancier shroom concoctions. They have this relaxing, thanks to the Reishi hot cocoa that I pretty much make every night with almond milk. They have matcha powder, which is the only matcha I now use. They have these magic mushroom chai latte packets that you can add to water or almond milk for a hot or iced, sweetest sippable treat. And I have to say, even though I don't drink coffee, Four Sigmatic is kind of famous for their multiple kinds of organic, much better for you coffee, even mocha mixes. So you can mocha chocolate. Okay, enough from me. I'm sorry. I just finished a mushroom matcha latte and I'm flying high. But because you listen to this podcast, thanks so much for doing that, by the way. You can save 15% off any and all Four Sigmatic shroomy stuff you'll want to buy off of their site, foursigmatic.com, using code PARTYINMYPLANTS. Or you can just go to foursigmatic, foursigmatic.com/PARTYINMYPLANTS to automatically save that 15%, baby. Oh, by the way, did I mention that I don't even really like eating mushrooms? Yeah, but now, thanks to Four Sigmatic, my body doesn't need to have shroom FOMO. Okay, again, hit up foursigmatic.com/partyofmyplants to save 15% on this mega boat floating stuff that I always find stuffed into my pockets, purses, luggage, or my bra because I just can't get enough. Hey, I'm in Italy right now, ringing in my 30th birthday by eating all the pizza and all the pasta. So I wanted to re-air this charming chat with a couple whose love affair with cooking healthy food was sparked by a love affair with Italy. So Sonia and Alex Overheiser, known on the interwebs as A Couple Cooks, are a writer and photographer duo behind the award-nominated food blog A Couple Cooks and the co-authors of the awesome cookbook Pretty Simple Cooking, which was named one of the best vegetarian cookbooks by Epicurious, and which lives on this special favorite cookbook section of my own cookbook library, I have to add. Their plant-forward approach to eating and their joy-filled approach to cooking, mixed with their humble approach to love, is what makes this couple pretty simply awesome. It was tricky business scheduling this interview with both Sonia and Alex, but I just couldn't settle for one half of the couple cooks, and I am so thrilled I get to share both of them with you now. Guys, thank you so much for both coming on my show today. What an honor to have the full couple of a couple cooks here.
Absolutely.
We're glad to be here.
Yay. It's so cool to hear your voices on my podcast because I've listened to every episode of your podcast.
Every episode?
Every, I think. Don't quote I'm me so on that. Don't quiz
I'm
me.
I'm so impressed. You want to listen to us for that many episodes? I love it.
Well, right when I got my book deal, I Googled like book deal podcast or book deal story, and you guys came up because I just wanted to like hear how other people's journeys were and stuff. And then I heard you, and then I binge listened to like all of your episodes, and then you went on a podcast hiatus.
That's right.
We'll be back.
We're currently on hiatus, but we're trying to formulate a new, improved, amazing season 2 of A Couple Cooks podcast.
Okay, good. Because it's great. I love it. And I love that you include like recipes, like you kind of talk through recipes, which is really cool. Never heard
Thank
that
you.
Before.
Yeah, we wanted to bring in the food element, but it can be difficult, as I'm sure you found, talking about food.
Yes.
Yes, because food is so visual and it's so sensory. And in a podcast, there isn't those things. And so we've found we really have had to rely on really good storytelling. So that's been a really fun challenge for us.
That's really, really cool. Well, let's talk about you guys being a couple of cooks in the kitchen and in business and in life. Was there like an aha moment when the idea of A Couple Cooks, at least the brand name, came to mind? Because I mean, that is golden. Like, that is the most brilliant brand name ever.
Well, thank you for saying that. I actually was the one who thought of it. And I pitched it to Alex and I said, what about A Couple Cooks? Like, it's kind of, you know, there's a double meaning there. And he was like, no, that's bad.
Why? No.
It was a little too rom-com for me.
Rom-com. It is a little rom-com,
hilarious.
But it's amazing.
Yes. So, but
I like rom-coms.
I kept saying it, and he eventually gave in begrudgingly. So we are a couple of cooks.
That's awesome. It's amazing. So how did the whole thing even start? And beyond the brand name, what inspired you guys as a couple to learn to cook?
Yeah. So we got married 11 years ago, almost to this day, in a couple weeks. Nice. And we bought a house. We live in Indianapolis and we bought a house here and we wanted to have people over for dinner at our new house, but we realized we had no knowledge of how to cook for them. So at the time I was eating Hot Pockets, Alex was eating Taco Bell. We were really just not into food at all. And back then the consciousness around food in our country was very different. Back then there weren't a lot of people that we knew who cared about the way that they ate. Mm-hmm. And so we just didn't really have any knowledge on what it would take to cook. So a coworker of mine lent me a cookbook by Julia Child. And that was the first cookbook that I read and realized this is a real person who's writing this. And she was so encouraging. And she said, you know, anyone can learn to cook. It doesn't matter if you haven't grown up cooking, you can learn how to do it. And that really stuck with us. And so we said, okay, we can learn how to cook. And so we tried a few recipes from her book for our first meal for the friends that came over, and it turned out. And that's what really hooked us of cooking, is just falling in love with that ability to take these ingredients, make something delicious, and then share it with people who you love.
It's funny. I was just recipe testing today for my upcoming book, and I usually play Friends in the background when I'm recipe testing or a podcast. And today, one of the Friends episodes, Monica's making, she made like a casserole or something, and Phoebe says, with the finished product, she's like, I can't believe a little while ago, these were just random ingredients.
Was it the cassoulet episode?
Where when she loses her nail.
Oh,
it's when Monica loses like a nail.
Okay, maybe that's not the right one. Either way, I love that you play Friends while you're cooking.
Yes. And it is, I mean, it is really remarkable when you haven't cooked before or even your beginner cook to get that finished product and be like, wait, I just put these things together and did some stuff, and now it's this. It's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, we really just fell in love with that concept that we could create things. We're both creative people, but we hadn't ever used those in the kitchen. And so it was fun to just make something up and have it taste good.
That's awesome. What was that first meal?
I don't know if it's the first one, but one of the first ones was we decided to just go fancy French. So this must have been the Julia Child cookbook.
Yes.
And so we had mashed celery root, which was delicious, and lamb chops.
This was before we started eating a lot of vegetables. I think we used mainly vegetarian.
We used fresh thyme. So using a fresh herb was very confusing and not something out of the cabinet. So
confusing.
A lot of new things going on all at once.
And thyme's a little tricky to get off, you know, the stem there.
It is. It takes me forever.
I don't even know if YouTube is as available as it was now, where you just ask it what to do.
Wow. So, yeah, Julia Child's is not what you would call, at least to my knowledge, like plant forward, right? Like it's not necessarily healthy food. I'm very planty. So how did you go from that meal realizing, oh, cooking's cool, we like this, to where you are now, which is eating a ton of plants?
So at that time, we were just consuming all food media because we loved it all. So Food Network and magazines, and we had our little Google Reader filled up with blogs. And I started following Mark Bittman, who was writing a weekly article for the New York Times called The Minimalist. And at that time, he had a book come out called Food Matters.
Mm-hmm.
And in that book, he just talks about eating a little bit less meat. Why don't you try one meal a day or one meal a week, and you'll have positive impact on your health, on the environment, on just about everything. And we just love that concept. Like, why don't we just moderately try eating a little bit less meat and see how it feels? And before long, we were eating mostly vegetarian.
Wow. Well, how long did that process take? Did you notice, you know, effects on your, at least your body and your health immediately when you started phasing out the meat?
Yeah. And I think it was more the processed food than just the meat, but it was all kind of all together where we just started. I think we said maybe we'll do this for 2 months and see how it feels. And we just never stopped, because by the time that 2 months was up, it just felt so great. It was we were tasting new things. So we were actually eating better food, and then better quality and better tasting food. And then we were eating food that was better for us. So it was a really great combination.
Yeah. And it sounds like this all just like happened kind of at once, in a very organic process, for lack of a better term, that you guys just stumbled into cooking and then fell in love with it, and then just consumed all this media, and then started transitioning your diet to winding up at this place where you now have an amazing plant forward cookbook out, which is crazy considering that, what, 11 years ago, you couldn't cook?
This is true. It is a little crazy now that you put it that way.
I'm very blunt.
No, it's true. It all just kind of happened at once. And around that time, in 2010, we had a personal blog where, you know, everybody had a personal blog in 2010 and talked about what you did that weekend. And so we found that we just kept showing pictures of food and food and food. And so we decided, hey, what if we just create a website that's just for food? And that's when I pitched Alex the idea of a couple cooks.
And I love that you pitched him an idea. Did you make like a whole PowerPoint? Like,
I should have. Actually, Alex is the PowerPoint guy. I just tried with, you know, my own persuasive personality. We decided to let's go ahead and start a food blog. Food blogs at that time were only maybe 3 to 4 years old. And so we actually had a friend here in Indianapolis who had a very successful food blog, and kind of talked to her, and then decided let's try this. And so we started posting recipes and almost immediately trying to kind of create our own original recipes and takes based on kind of some of the things that we were learning in the cookbooks that we were cooking from. And started taking some very terrible photos at the time and writing some very uninspiring blog posts. But we were just so excited about eating more vegetables and the way that they tasted. And now when I speak, I say, you know, it wasn't the same back in 2010. No one that we knew had heard of quinoa, you know, like no one.
Or how to pronounce it.
Yeah, exactly. And I remember one of my first blog posts was like, here's how you pronounce it. And here's what it is. And things have changed tremendously since then. So it's actually very exciting to be on this side and see how the internet has just transformed the way that people think about food in this country. But back then, there wasn't as much awareness. And so that's kind of why we started it, of saying, here are some really delicious ways to eat plants. And that's why we started. And that's what fueled the passion behind A Couple of Cooks.
Were people like, what are you doing? Why are you writing about quinoa? Did people, were they receptive to it? Would you be cooking this food when, like, it sounds like you really got into, you know, having people over to eat, I assume, based on that first experience. Like, were people like, ew, like, what is this? Did they reject it? Did people embrace it? Like your family and friends?
Oh, we had a bit of a mixed bag. Some of our family thought we might die of protein deficiency if we're eating less meat.
This is very true.
Oh my God.
But then other ones were like kind of like the challenge of, can we make something that they'll love? And overall, we are such relational people. We always try to make food that everybody would love. And so that's a big part of our brand now and what our cookbook is. It's a vegetarian cookbook, but it's food that you could feed to the biggest carnivore in the world. And hopefully they won't even notice that the meat was missing.
That's awesome. What was the hardest part, if you can think back to when you were like transitioning and that sounds weird, but like shifting your diet as well as learning how to cook, going from not cooking and eating lots of processed food to cooking and eating all these plants? Like, what were some of the hardest parts of that journey for you?
I think a lot of it for me was failures in the kitchen. Failure is just a part of cooking, especially when you're developing recipes on your own and trying to be creative. There's a lot of failure that happens when you're trying to kind of go outside the box and explore things. And that is not something that I was used to. I love, you know, doing things right the first time. And so when I would fail in the kitchen, I would be like, oh man, like, I don't even know why I'm trying to do this. And Alex would come alongside me and say, that's okay. You know, like, we made something gross today. Like, let's try again tomorrow. Or we took a very, very bad picture of this recipe that's delicious. Let's try again tomorrow. And so I think that embracing that there needs to be some failure and trial and error in the kitchen was the biggest obstacle that I faced early on. And we actually talk about that in our cookbook. We have these 10 lessons that talk about kind of the ways that, like, kind of mantras that we've learned along the way, where it wasn't a switch overnight for us. It wasn't a, like, here we are, now we're eating plants all the time and cooking healthy at home. It was a long transition. And so learning kind of these life lessons about, you know, you might have failure, was a really big part of the way that we were able to transition the way that we cook and eat.
Yeah, it's funny. As you were talking, I went to my notes and I underlined face your fear, which is one of your 10 life lessons in your cookbook.
That's the one.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because you guys talk about that a lot, like facing your fear and failure in the kitchen. And maybe I'm playing it too safe, but I don't have that. I'm not like a genius in the kitchen. I think I just play really safe. You guys must be doing a lot of really ambitious, cool, really out of the box stuff. Because I'm just like making overnight oats and I'm like, yeah, I got this. Do you experience a lot of other people and like beginners having that fear as well?
I think a lot of it just depends on personality. I actually don't mind failing in the kitchen. It's kind of my favorite part. I'll just set something on fire and see if it tastes good. And if not, so well. So I think different personalities where just can really depend on how you approach the way you cook.
Well, it's like life.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think, I mean, we really experiment with recipes and kind of push them to their limits. I remember talking to my mom about this and she was like, well, I don't fail in the kitchen. Like, oh, well, maybe you like follow recipes, but
right,
we're doing
just
a
makes
lot
oatmeal
of
like me.
Right. Oh, we're doing a lot of things to kind of push boundaries at the same time. But I think
that's so cool.
What we hear from a lot of people who are just starting out is they try something and it takes way longer than the recipe says, or they try something and it's gross and they're like, I don't want to eat plant-based. This tastes bad, you know? And I think that is, you know, though we chalk those up to, okay, that's a learning experience. And next time I'm going to pick a recipe that doesn't take that long, or I'm going to read through it and think, how long will this take me? Or I'm just going to try a new flavor combination. I think a lot of those initial failures are kind of what make or break some people's perception of the kitchen, because they just quit and they say, oh, well, I can't figure it out. So I'm not going to keep going.
Yeah. Well, how do you help people keep going when they, you know, don't want to? I mean, I love how your cookbook, you're really clear about how long things take. You know, it's like that is a huge barrier to entry for most people, especially, I mean, you guys cook like all the time during the week with your jobs and your son and all that. I mean, that's a hard thing when you have jobs and family and, you know, getting in the kitchen and preparing real food is a huge hurdle for many people.
Yeah, for us, we've really tried to orient our lives where that's a part of the time that we're spending together with family, where it is cooking is family time.
Oh, or I love that.
Fun, creative time. So we don't mind missing out on one extra episode of Netflix if instead we spend that extra 20 minutes cooking. And for us, it's a really pleasurable thing instead of a thing we have to get through to get food on the table.
I love looking at it like that.
And that actually is a lesson. It's another lesson in the book.
Gather and share.
Exactly.
Nailed it. I wrote down four of my favorite lessons and we've already tackled two organically. Right. How beautiful.
And that's one of my favorite things of, I feel like having people over for dinner is something we love. And something we've realized is that even though we love having people over for dinner, we don't always have to have food on the table when they arrive. A lot of times we'll tell our friends, come over and cook with us, and we'll cook through recipes together. And that time is as fun and the conversation is as good as when we actually sit down together and enjoy the food. So it's really good for us to just share the time together cooking, and then you don't have to prepare everything before people show up.
That is brilliant. I've never heard anyone say that before. And, you know, most people, when they have people over for dinner or a party or whatever, it's that hour or two before everyone arrives that they're manic and they're crazy and they're so stressed and they're sweating and they're ruining their outfits and they're just like, why did I invite people over? And it's this whole thing. But what you're saying is like the perfect solution to that, to have everyone come and like participate. That is, that's brilliant.
And if you have a bit of wine,
yes,
and a few apps, really easy apps on hand, it's so much fun.
I love that. What are your go-to apps for having on hand in those kinds of situations?
Well, we love olives. So just having, like, sometimes we marinate them or just have them out. They're super easy. We like to buy the ones that are canned in water. So they're a little bit less briny and salty than the typical olive. And then like hummus.
The irresistible tomato almond dip from our cookbook.
True.
That one is
that takes
very
only
popular.
Like 5 minutes to whip up. Mm-hmm. So it's just like almonds and canned tomatoes and a few spices. Just really easy stuff like that. And we think a lot about kind of the user experience of the kitchen. We've realized that's actually part of what we did in our day jobs previously, was really think about making things user friendly. And so we think about that a lot when we're in the kitchen. Okay, if people are coming over, you don't want to spend hours getting together your appetizers, right? You just want something quick and simple so that you can have those out while you're getting the rest of the meal ready. So we're very conscious about the way that people's lives are oriented and the way people move through the kitchen.
That's so cool. That's very unique. That's awesome. Wait, but you said previously in our day jobs, that implies that is in the past. Is there something presently that does not involve day jobs?
Yeah. So we transitioned from our day jobs. I was at the same job for 13 years, Alex for 11. We actually worked at the same company. So we worked for a technical writing firm. Yeah.
Oh.
I was his boss. I just like to mention that part.
You say that as though it's past tense.
Oh, not even. So we worked in the technical writing industry. So we wrote kind of user manuals and instructions and tried to kind of codify what was in engineers' brains, really technical things, and make them palatable for the everyday person. So we would kind of translate what an engineer meant when he designed a product and then translate that to the end user. So we actually use those skills in what we do today because that's what writing a recipe is. That's thinking about who's our user, what kind of tools do they have, what's the variation in kitchens across America, across the world, what kind of ingredients do people have access to. And so that really kind of shapes our method of the way that we write recipes. And we try to make them as user-friendly as possible because we know what it's like to be a cook who doesn't know how to do anything. We started at zero. And so we think about that every time we write a recipe.
That is so cool. I had no idea that that's what you guys did. What kind of like products have you written manuals for?
Well, all sorts of stuff like how to install a satellite dish to medical device to Wow. Locks for RVs. You know, we just really covered it all.
Oh my God. So you would have to be the translator, like between the brainiac people who just know the technical stuff and the common folk.
Exactly. Yeah. Wow. So we would be talking to people with like PhDs in mathematics and try to understand what the heck they're saying and then translate that to the everyday person.
That sounds really fun. I'm sure after 11 and 13 years, maybe not as fun, but it sounds really fun right now.
It was really interesting. And I actually come from a totally artistic background. I was a music major and journalism major in college. But there was something about kind of figuring out this puzzle and then telling other people about it. That was really intriguing to me. Like, I love learning. And so I loved like learning about these new things and how things work and then telling other people how to use them. And I just loved software, like trying to explain how to do a certain task within a software program. So a lot of that is very transferable to the kitchen.
Oh, it's like perfect. It's literally the most transferable skill, I feel like. That's awesome. So you guys worked together in your day jobs, but then you took on this other life, this A Couple Cooks, as another partnership. What is that like? I mean, man, you guys are just attached at the hip. It's amazing. How does that work? Do you ever like get sick of each other? Do you have just perfect synergy? You know your strengths and weaknesses and you just sort of like play off each other. I mean, that's really special.
Kind of both of those.
We've been together for, I don't even know, 17 years. And so I feel like at this point we're moving along pretty good and we know how to work each other's strengths and weaknesses. There were a few rough years there early on where you just both are trying to butt heads and do everything. And actually early on when we were blogging, we both tried writing posts and we both tried taking pictures and we just realized that wasn't working. So I kind of focused more on the graphical side since that was my skill set and Sonia would write. And then we shared the kitchen where we both love to cook. And so we found ways to share things and also work our strengths.
That is so fun. So who does the cleaning? The dish cleaning.
Yeah, both of us do. We do share
or
that.
Or neither
that
of task. Us.
Yeah. Or neither. Right. Yeah. We were actually just cleaning our house from top to bottom today. And we are very messy people. I think people think that they see the pictures of our white kitchen and pretty food photos, and they think that we're really clean and organized. But we're actually behind the scenes, we're pretty messy.
You should do some like behind the scenes photos.
Expose.
Yeah, reveal yourselves. Let your true colors come out. So now you've quit those day jobs and you're doing cooking full time?
We are. Yeah.
Wow, so congrats.
Thank you. When our son was born, our son Larson was born almost a year and a half ago, and we transitioned around that time. I transitioned first and then Alex at the end of last year. So yeah, we are maintaining our food blog, and then we had our book come out in February, and I'm doing some freelance writing and photography and making it work.
That's amazing. Well, for couples that are listening who cannot even imagine getting in the kitchen with their other half and not like injuring each other or like getting in a fight, you know, what is some advice, if any, you have for couples to make cooking together more fun?
I think if one person is a more experienced cooker than the other, it would be fun to try something
new.
Say
cooker?
Cook than the other.
Cook or the others, I think. But I like cooker.
I'm a more experienced cooker than you are.
I like that.
I'll say that one again.
Sorry. I was just trying to be funny.
No, you were. That was very funny. So
sorry.
I love this. So if someone's more experienced as a cook or a cooker than the other.
The best cooker. No, I think trying something new together so that neither of you kind of has that upper hand and you can both experience something new. So try a recipe that neither of you have tried. And that way you can try it together and see what you find out.
Level the playing field there.
Exactly. Exactly. So I think a lot of people are intimidated when their better half is a better half.
I think that's true. That's a good point. Do you guys like divvy up the duties when you cook together? Like someone's, you know, mise en placing the spices and the herbs and the other one's like grilling the stuff and some, you know, like do you do that? How do you like divvy up the tasks?
Yeah, we do. We actually, we tend to use, have one person be the chef and one person be the sous chef each recipe.
So
then we switch back and forth. So if you're the chef, you can kind of say, okay, Alex, go chop this stuff for me or whatever. So we have found that with one person running the show, it's a lot easier than having two people run the show. So we switch off with that. And then that helps to just kind of divvy up the tasks.
And only one person is responsible for knowing how long to set the timer and that sort of thing. So you're not blaming each other.
Look at you guys just know all the answers to having harmony, at least in the kitchen. At least
you know, we have learned the hard way. So don't think it's been easy to get here.
No, that's awesome. So someone, you'll be like, okay, well, Alex, like you're the chef today. You're the chef for this recipe.
Right. Like, and usually
does he get like a special hat?
You should.
Like an apron.
That would be funny. Yeah. No, usually we're typically making recipes that we've developed. And so usually one or the other of us will also take the lead on a recipe development. So Alex will say, I want to make this grill a little veggie burger, and he'll write it up and then pitch it to me and say, what do you think of this? And I'll say, sounds good, but you should use less garlic and use this or that. And then, so he would naturally be the chef for that recipe.
Mm. It sounds like you guys have a wonderful way of not like bringing your egos into your relationship, or at least, you know, in your kitchen partnership where, you know, if you're like, you should use more garlic or less garlic, like Alex isn't like fighting back. It doesn't sound like he gets his feelings hurt. And I think that's really important. And that's definitely something that my fiance and I are not great at. Like if I'm like, what do you think? He's like, ugh, like not enough salt. Then I'm like mad at him. I'm like, you just didn't have a good bite or something. You know, like I feel like you really have to leave your ego out of the kitchen.
Still happens on occasion, but we've learned when the other person has a good opinion. And every once in a while, I'll just say, hey, you know what? I'm going to go make this and it's going to taste bad and I don't care. And then it tastes bad. And then she says, I told you so. But
and I've learned to let go in that situation and say, okay, our marriage is a lot more valuable than this recipe that he wants to make for me. So go ahead, make this really bad recipe and I'll just eat it and throw it in the garbage and then, you know, we'll call it a day. So I've realized it's just a lot easier, you know, just in all things to kind of pick your battles, right?
There you go. Yes. All this stuff is just a metaphor for life.
It really is.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful. So who makes more of the recipes? Like it sounds like you both make an equal distribution, but Alex, you take the photos.
Yeah, I would say we are pretty much 50-50 on recipe development, but I do the photos, I do the web design and that sort of thing, and then Sonia does all the writing, so we share tasks pretty evenly.
And I participate in the shoot and do some of the kind of the art direction. I used to do more styling, now Alex kind of does more of the styling part, but I'm always there watching, tweaking, saying move the spoon a centimeter that way or whatever.
Who's the better baker?
Alex by far.
Oh,
he does all. Oh yeah. He does all of our, so we don't do a ton of like baked sweets. We do a lot of pizza dough and bread. He does sourdough bread every day.
Oh,
it's pretty amazing. This is a new practice. It's probably been six months.
Wait, tell me more about this. You make sourdough every day?
Pretty much. We have a starter that we keep in a jar and I either feed it every day or more often I make bread. And Larson loves it. So Larson's a little bit spoiled. He doesn't eat store-bought bread.
Oh my God. You're ruining him.
I know.
Wait, can you explain more about how this process works? What does that mean? You feed your starter? Where do you keep it? What is a starter? How do you make the bread?
Do you have at least 3 hours?
No.
So the sourdough starter, you get, it's just a mixture of flour and natural yeast and bacteria.
So that, he like pulled it down from the atmosphere. It was amazing. You can just like harvest
it from
the atmosphere.
You can just make a starter in your own kitchen.
What?
But we won't get into that.
You guys need to make a video on this or something.
It's on our list.
But okay. We're hoping
it's not
this.
Pretty simple. So we're trying to figure out how to simplify
That's
it.
That's true. Yeah.
So I just collected yeast out of our air and that created
no
a starter.
Deal. Obviously.
That takes like a week or so.
Just grab the yeast from the air, put it in a jar.
Once you have a happy starter, it's this live yeast. And so it'll eat through like a cup of flour every day. So you either have to use that starter to make bread or you throw it out and feed it more flour.
Oh,
And so it's just constantly eating flour and making a really delicious tangy flavor.
Now that sounds really cute. Like there's a little monster and he's like gobbling, but it really just looks like gooey dough. Like,
wow.
Dough yeah, it smells goes, a bit yeah, nasty,
yeah,
but it tastes delicious.
Wow. That's amazing.
So then when you make bread, you don't use instant yeast. You use a fair amount of the starter, and that's what adds the yeast to the bread and then it leavens naturally.
How long does the bread take to make? You know, once you have the starter and you're like, okay, I'm making my daily bread, apparently, because that's how you guys live, which is amazing. like, how long does the bread take?
I mix the starter, let's say, on Friday night. On Saturday afternoon, I mix the bread and do a couple things to it every half hour for about 2 hours. Then I put it in the fridge. And then Sunday morning, I bake it. So it's a 3-day process, but it's not a lot of hands-on time.
That's amazing.
And I tune out for all of this. So I'm just like, whatever, like go do your thing. And then there's bread. It's pretty sweet.
I mean, that's a sweet life. That is a sweet life to have fresh made sourdough bread just waiting for you. What are your guys' favorite things to do with your sourdough bread?
I mean, I'm really simple. I just make peanut butter toast with it and it's delicious.
That's perfect. What's the toast you guys have in your book? What do you call it? California toast?
Yeah. Good memory. Thanks. So California toast is a really fun way to eat bread and make it into kind of a French toast. So we made up the name California toast because it was kind of a fresh take on French toast. And it's just taking your bread, slice it into a triangle and put some almond butter on it. If you can make it at home, that's great. If you buy it from store, that's okay. And then put it on a plate, top it with some berries and maybe bananas, whatever fun toppings you want, and then drizzle it with syrup and eat it with a knife and fork. So it feels like French toast, but you don't have to do any of that prep. There's no eggs and frying and all that stuff. It's just a really fresh, delicious whole food version of it.
And the photo of it in your book is amazing.
Oh, thank you.
OMG. The photo, I can see it in my mind right now with the drizzle. It's just like there. It's beautiful. It makes me so hungry.
Based on something we had at a restaurant. And what I love about, you know, like simple cooking is that you can take these the regular things that you have around your house, but you may not have thought of combining them in that certain way. And so I felt like this was such a great way to do French toast, basically like a fancy breakfast for kids where you don't have to run around and like whisk your eggs and fry your bread. You can just put it together really simply and and make a meal out of these components that you might not have thought of putting together.
Yeah, it's awesome. Pardon me for a sec, but have you met Ned? I love you if you've got that reference. And I love Ned, but Jesse needn't worry because Ned isn't a secret second husband. He's premium small batch hemp products that go from seeds in the Rocky Mountains of Colorado to bottle that you can use wherever the heck you live. I'm talking bottles of hemp oil, hemp body butter, and even hemp chapstick that my effed up East Coast winter lips are hella thankful for right now. Before you ask, why doesn't Ned just call its products CBD? I'll answer. Because of FDA regulations, only pharmaceutical companies can use the term CBD. So Ned's sticking to the rules by saying that their products are made from full spectrum hemp. But between you and me, we're talking CBD here, friend. Ned's organic, non-GMO, small batch products won't get you high. Sorry, but they will help as a sleep aid. They'll provide anti-inflammatory powers. They'll serve as a natural pain reliever. Been rubbing that body butter on my always sore feet and they say, thanks, Ned. It'll help with anxiety. Yes, please. And thank you. And provide you with antioxidants on fleek. I am admittedly a CBD noob, but you gotta believe this noob when she says that her experience with Ned's CBD is it works like ABC. Easy as 1, 2, 3. Simple as do, re, mi. And it really did help me with tons of anxiety that I was feeling as I was finishing my book, which I just did. Yay. Okay. You knew this was coming. You can save 15% on all your Ned needs and desires if you head to helloned.com/plants or use code plants at checkout on helloned.com. That's helloned.com/party to save 15% on our buddy old pal Ned's full spectrum hemp oils that won't get you high, but will nourish your body's endocannabinoid, fancy pants, system, which helps bring balance to your mind and your body. Thanks, Ned. See you at helloned.com/party. And now back to our episode. You mentioned simple cooking. You just did. And I'm just curious what you guys would define as simple cooking.
I actually meant pretty simple cooking.
That's fine. So, pretty simple cooking.
Yeah, how would so you we said pretty it? Simple because we feel like cooking isn't easy and it's not necessarily simple. But it's pretty simple once you kind of orient your life around the kitchen. And so for us, pretty simple cooking is making recipes that are made of real foods. They're delicious.
And pretty.
They're made. Yeah, they're pretty. Yeah, exactly. They're pretty and delicious. But they're also like accessible. They're made out of ingredients that you can get at your grocery or you potentially you could be growing in a garden, but they're not hard to find ingredients. And they're using methods that are pretty simple. And like Alex said, sourdough bread, that is not pretty simple. That is like pretty complicated. And so we didn't include things like that. We wanted to have a book for everyone. And that means people who are just starting out, but also people who are tried and true cooks who also just really appreciate a simple, beautiful, delicious recipe.
I love it. So it's like pretty simple. Right. Is the tone.
And then you have the double meaning of the pretty and simple.
One of my favorite examples from the book is our creme fraiche recipe because it's extraordinarily simple. You just take whipping cream and you leave it out and then and add a little bit of yogurt. It ferments and it creates the most wonderful, flavorful creme fraiche that you can use on anything. And the simple part is you don't do anything. The pretty simple part is that it takes 3 days. So you have to think
ahead. That's funny.
And so I feel like those are the type of recipes that we love where you just think ahead a little bit, this becomes a super gourmet item and it only takes you 5 minutes.
That's so cool. That's so fun. I love it. I love all your double meanings. You guys are really good at those.
We have at least two of them.
Yes. We talked about them both. Well, you mentioned thinking ahead, and I feel like that's actually a real big struggle for a lot of people. I mean, whenever I do a podcast where people mention meal prepping or meal planning, people go wild for it. I think it's a real big struggle that a lot of people face. Do you guys have any advice for families on how they can think ahead, like you were just mentioning?
Yeah. I mean, I like the concept of thinking ahead. I don't like the concept of meal prep. So for some reason, and I think it's great when people want to meal prep. I am not that type of person.
Me neither.
For whatever reason. Okay, good.
I wing it every single night. So when people come to me, they're like, how do I meal plan? How do I make a, you know, meal prep? I'm like, I don't know. I just make extra when I make anything.
Susie over
like,
there.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, but that's not to say we don't think ahead. So we definitely are planning when we want to have certain meals. We just don't do a lot of like Sunday, make the rice for this, make the quinoa for that. You know, that's just, I don't know. I think it, for artist personalities, it kind of makes you feel really depressed.
Yeah.
So, but we think ahead a lot.
And one thing we always do is try to make a huge batch so we have leftovers and we really embrace leftovers.
Yes.
And so that kind of gives you an extra day or two of getting around thinking ahead.
What are some of your favorite leftover meals? Does that make sense? Like meals that generate leftovers that you love.
I think especially in the winter soups, like we always make a double batch of soup because a lot of times they taste even better the next day.
Yes, when the flavors all hang out together overnight.
Exactly. And we just love to, you know, make any recipe and then figure out how to use it in a different way the next day. Maybe we roasted cauliflower and then the next day we put it in a tortilla and make cauliflower tacos or, you know, there are so many different ways that you can be creative with food. And we kind of like to think towards the end of the week, we do kind of like a chopped style competition with each other. I mean, informally, but we'll say like,
I'm like envisioning like, okay, here we go. Like Larson's there like judging.
That would be amazing. No, we're not that organized, but we'll say like, okay, what can we make with all these random things in our refrigerator? And some of our best ideas have come out of just like happenstance things that happen to be in our refrigerator. So that's kind of more of what we do in terms of rhythms, is that we tend to make recipes early in the week. We don't necessarily meal prep for them, but we'll think of them in advance and shop for them in advance. And then towards the end of the week, we just kind of use up leftovers. And then we use the weekend for cooking and having fun and having people over for dinner. And then hopefully we'll have some leftovers from that to tide us into the next week.
So you guys are real leftovers people.
Oh, yeah. I have a friend who doesn't like leftovers.
My mom hates them.
Quite sure I'm how sure she too. Exists.
I don't understand it. My dad's a big leftover dude, but my mom will just like look at them in the fridge and it won't even be an option for her. Like she's automatically, if it's in a container in the fridge, she's never going to eat it. And I'm just like, how? Why? Why? Why are you hating?
Yeah, I don't understand that either. And like I said, we love being creative with it. So for us, it's like a challenge of what can we come up with.
And worst case scenario, you like add some cheese and sourdough bread and you have like a sandwich, no matter what the leftover is. Exactly.
There you go. That's where that sourdough, the daily sourdough really comes in handy. So one thing I also wanted to have you guys define, another one of your 10 life lessons that is my favorite, is just simply cook real food. That's one of that's your first life lesson, right? From your book.
Yes. Yeah.
So I'm curious what you guys would define as real food.
Yeah. So when we started kind of being more thoughtful about the way we ate, was the era of, as Alex mentioned, Mark Bittman and then Michael Pollan. Mm-hmm. If you know his mantra, eat food, not too much, mostly plants.
Yep.
That's a pretty popular saying that people have gravitated towards. And a lot of people have kind of changed it into eat real food. And around that time, this real food movement came into play where it was focused on, let's not be eating a lot of processed stuff. Let's eat real food ingredients. And what he says in one of his books is like, would your great grandmother recognize this as a food? Mm-hmm. If not, don't eat it. So we kind of go with that rule. I mean, we just say, you know, like fruits, vegetables, grains, et cetera, et cetera. For us, bread is real food. And we try not to be too like strict about it. We just try to cook with as many just kind of real ingredients as possible and make things as much at home as we can.
Mm-hmm. I think early on, we were really shocked when we started reading labels and seeing the stuff that was in some of the foods that you thought was real foods. Like I was looking at pickles the other day and realizing how many pickle jars had 15 ingredients, and then one or two of them would have like 4 ingredients, and that's all that pickles really need. And so you just need to like reorient your grocery shopping around paying attention to what you're actually buying.
Totally. And yeah, once you start looking at it, it becomes really simple, pretty simple once you start reading the labels and you realize what is food, real food, and what is not, and what stuff has so much stuff added and that's unnecessary.
Exactly. Yeah. And we really try to come at it from a place of, not from a place of fear, you know, of like, oh no, there's this many ingredients in it, but just as a, you know, a simple way of looking at things and saying, okay, I'm going to just try to get the one with the least ingredients. Mm-hmm. And then we realized that those usually taste better. And the things that we were making with these real food ingredients tasted 1,000 times better than the things that had 1,000,000 ingredients in them. But we also really tried to embrace a moderation approach in that of, you know, like, we are going to try to do this as much as we can, but if we don't do it 100% of the time, that's okay. And that is another one of the reasons that we're still doing this today, is that we have an approach that's filled with joy and the embracing the fun of it and not being motivated by fear of scary ingredients.
I love that. And as I'm thinking about how you guys said, you know, 11 years ago, you were eating Hot Pockets and what was the other one?
Taco Bell.
It's fascinating. Like, how did your taste buds react to the real food entering your mouth? Because some people, when you're used to eating Hot Pockets and Taco Bell, I imagine would think that kale is disgusting. Like Jim Gaffigan, one of my favorite comedians who has that whole bit on Hot Pockets. Yeah. He has a famous joke about, I don't care if they told me kale cured cancer, I would take the chemo, because he just makes fun of how terrible kale is. So like, I'm wondering what that was like for you guys. Like, were your taste buds enjoying the healthy food, or like, how did that work?
I think I'm a bit of an anomaly because I grew up on a farm. And so growing up, I ate a lot of really high quality fruits. And I was always just like told to go to the vegetable crisper if I wanted a snack. And oh, so wow. I always loved vegetables, even though I gravitated towards Taco Bell.
Huh.
And so I didn't have that effect. But to me, more, it was shocking how good things could taste. Like, I didn't think I liked Brussels sprouts because they were frozen or in a can and just nasty. But when you buy them fresh and you roast them, they taste amazing. And so stuff like that, where you realize foods that like kale, if you have bad preparations, they're no good. But if you have good preparations, they're amazing.
Maybe Jim Gaffigan is eating like just raw kale. He's just like biting.
Yeah, it's probably not massage. I don't know what he's doing. Poor Jim.
I think Sonia, especially, she wasn't super picky, but she just didn't gravitate towards foods that, especially out of season, like strawberries or tomatoes that just didn't have any flavor. It kind of blew her mind.
Yeah, it's funny. Like, my whole life, I didn't like tomatoes until I was in my mid-20s was when this was kind of happening. And I had a local tomato from our farmer's market here. And I was like, oh, like, now I get why people like tomatoes.
Wow.
This makes so much more sense.
Wow. Yeah, you can really taste the difference with these plants.
Absolutely. And especially like, even we have like a couple strawberries outside in our garden, and tasting those off the vine is totally different than those like huge kind of whitish pink strawberries in a mm-hmm. plastic container.
I didn't even know they made or they sold canned Brussels sprouts.
I don't know what I had. Maybe they're just frozen. But they weren't
I'm like, Brussels. Still, you mentioned canned Brussels sprouts. And I'm like, wait, maybe that's
a
thing.
We probably did. I think we did.
I think like in the 50s, my dad was also very against Brussels sprouts. So I think he may have had them.
I feel like that's what I'd always take when we were told to take a can to school to donate.
Get these out of my house. Oh, yeah, that's so funny. So then you guys must have an amazing way you prepare Brussels sprouts. I have to know. What's your favorite way to make them?
It's actually in the book. It is, oh, we love to roast them. Yes. We love to roast them at super high heat. So 450. And we coat them in olive oil, a little bit of kosher salt and pepper, roast them real quickly. So about 15-ish minutes. And then pull them out. You actually don't need to put any cheese on them. In the book, we put a little pecorino cheese on just to really enhance that savory flavor. But the leaves get really crispy, a little bit browned in the oven, and they kind of taste like little potato chips. Mm. So good.
Oof. See, you're so good at describing food too. Like, you just really have a gift for describing it and making us hungry.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. Except it's late now and I'm craving Brussels sprouts. So you guys got married a long time ago. I'm getting married in a few months. I'm wondering what advice you have for someone like me on things to register for a kitchen. I feel like when you guys got married, you weren't in the kitchen. You just wanted Taco Bell gift cards or more extra freezer for your Hot Pockets. So like, if you went back in time, I'm just curious, what are like five things you would have loved to have registered for?
Yes, we did make that mistake, and we have ended up replacing most of our kitchen gear that was not of great quality 10 years ago. I think number one is, instead of a big knife block, getting a good chef's knife or two. If you are really passionate about cooking together, then you can have two knives, but you don't need a knife block that's the same price but has six knives. Just get one good knife.
That is so helpful. Yeah, because my fiance actually, I have a great knife that I love, love, love. And he wanted to get us a block, a register for the block. And I'm like, I don't really understand. Like, I have an amazing knife. Let's just get another, you know, amazing knife. That's great advice. You guys each have your own knives. Are they like color coded for
one's I like one that's a little bit bigger. So I have like a giant chef's knife and Sonia has a medium sized one.
Oh, there you go. So you
it's very manly. He likes to have like the biggest like the whatever tool. Yeah.
Whatever. He needs to establish himself in the kitchen.
Exactly.
Okay, that's great advice. You guys are chock full of great advice. Okay, two chef's knives.
So another thing is if you are a bit of an experienced cook and you know like what size of pots you like to cook with, I'd recommend instead of getting a big set, it's kind of the same theme. Don't get a big set of kitchen pots and pans. Buy two or three of the saucepans you like, one big spaghetti pot, and buy them kind of individually. The same brand or whatever if you like, but that way you use get the ones you use, because I think we got like a big 14 piece set and we would use the spaghetti pot and we use the meat skillet and then have like 12 pieces you don't use, and so
it's so true,
get the pieces that you're going to use.
That's so smart. It's so true. So you use the most, it sounds like, your spaghetti, medium size, and saucepan.
Exactly.
Nice. Same. We have the worst. Mine are like IKEA. I don't know why I won't invest. Now I'm going to register for it. Perfect advice. Anything else?
People buy them for you.
Do you guys? Yeah, totally. Do you guys use a mixer, like a stand mixer or whatever?
We have one. We got it as a gift, but it's not like our go-to everyday thing. We use a food processor a lot more in a high-speed blender, like a Vitamix or that sort.
Yeah, totally. I think those are a big wedding gift that people get because it's cute and pretty, but then it just takes up so much counter space. Those
yeah,
mixers.
I mean, we've used it a handful of times, but it's really, we have a copper one, so we love the way it looks.
Yeah, that's pretty. That's awesome. Okay, so would you say those are the two things, the individual pots and the knives?
Then I guess the third thing would be not to just choose cheap, get something quality, because you're going to use them forever, you're going to be married forever, so get the good stuff.
Yes, I love that. Pick your kitchen equipment like you pick your partner.
Yeah,
for life.
Exactly.
For life. So I can't let you go without mentioning my fourth favorite life lesson of yours from your book, which is to slow down. I love that. And it sounds like, you know, based on how you guys talk about cooking together and cooking with guests, it just sounds like for you, cooking is slowing down because you're not just like, I gotta cook food and then eat it. Like eating is the focus. It's the whole process. Do you have any other thoughts and advice for people who really would like to and should and might benefit from slowing down when it comes to food?
Yeah, I was raised in a household where time was the most important thing in the kitchen and making the cooking part as short as possible. So I grew up thinking that it was a race and that we wanted to not spend time in the kitchen because we wanted to be eating the food, which was actually, my mom is a fantastic cook. We had really great food, but we spent as little time in the kitchen as possible. So when I met Alex and married him, he helped me kind of see like, why are you trying to go so fast? Why don't you slow down and enjoy this process of dicing an onion or sauteing it and smelling the aroma or, you know, like going out to the garden and getting some herbs and chopping them. That was not something that was part of my just worldview, I guess, was, you know, the kitchen is supposed to be where you don't spend time.
Yeah.
And so now we have just flipped it on its head. And it, as Alex mentioned before, it's the place where we spend so much time. And a lot of what we did in terms of slowing down was just kind of reprioritizing. Like he mentioned earlier, maybe we don't need to fit in one more Netflix show. Maybe we want to spend a little bit more time in our evening shopping or preparing for creating a meal. And so a lot of it was just kind of carving out that time in our life. We didn't get 2 more hours in our day or 4 more hours. We just reprioritized so that we were spending more of our time in the kitchen.
It's a really freeing way to look at it, what you're saying, you know, that instead of just sitting in front of the TV and watching a Netflix show and that being how you connect, making the food process part of the connection. And that is just such a really beautiful way of looking at it. And I mean, I admittedly don't even really look at it like that myself. You know, And that, I don't know, I just feel so refreshed as you're describing. I think that's just such a wonderful way of looking at it, and reprioritizing and rethinking what cooking is can really make a massive difference, I think, for somebody who's resentful of cooking for themselves. You know, a lot of people are like, oh, it's just so much easier to get takeout or drive through. But when you make the cooking a joyful experience, then that flips it on its head, like you said.
Yeah, and we're even trying to teach that to Larson. He's only 16 months old, so when he has an immediate hunger, it's pretty immediate. But lately, like if I'm going to make him an egg, instead of trying to distract him for 5 minutes, I put him in his high chair and bring him over where he can see the stove, and I show him what I'm doing. I don't think he truly gets it, but he understands that you have to blow on it before you eat it because it's hot. But I feel like just seeing that process for him, putting on some music, enjoying it, it doesn't have to be this stressful, oh my gosh, my son's starving, everybody's yelling. It can be something he can even join in.
That's great. Yeah, I was going to ask you, do you play music or a podcast, or like what do you do? Because you spend a lot of time in the kitchen. Like what's going on in the background?
Yeah, usually it's music. We have a little Google Home speaker, so we're always yelling at it. Either a timer for what we're cooking or for what we're listening to.
Oh, cool. Is it an Alexa thing?
Yeah, it's like Alexa, but it's Google. She's saying, okay, different. Cool. Yeah.
So Google, set a 10-minute timer and also play Call Me Maybe. Yep.
Exactly.
Why is that the first song that came to my mind? I don't know.
That's a good dishwashing song.
Yeah, you guys do a little dancing in there.
Exactly.
Well, since Larson has come into the picture, has your philosophy in the kitchen or your food philosophy changed at all? Has preparing different types of meals that he can also eat been a challenge or an interesting experience?
It's been a bit of a surprise for us, but we found that from 6 months when he started eating solid foods, we just offer him what we're eating and he's really kind of gravitated towards that. We have some of the basics, yogurt and peanut butter and bananas, that he can eat anytime, but usually he wants what's on our plate, so we just share that.
Wow, like adult food.
Yeah, pretty simple food.
Yeah, nice.
But we've found that there doesn't really need to be a distinction for most things between adult and kid food. You know, he eats what, if we're eating a soup, he's eating that. Or if we're eating a pizza, he's eating that. Or if we're eating tacos, he's eating that. So a lot of it is just, you know, food. And he loves it. So
that's amazing.
The other day we had sriracha on the table and he really wanted to try it. So we let him and he wasn't too impressed. But, you know. You got to try it sometime.
We're trying to get him used to it from an early age.
That's so funny. Did he make a really funny face?
Yeah, it was really like time delayed too. He's like, yum, yum. And then, oh.
Oh, yeah. Oh my God. It's so cute. He's the cutest. Talk to me about you guys and your pizza. You guys are really big pizza people.
We are. We're very obsessed.
I've heard you talk about it a lot on your podcast and even like other interviews you've done. Pizza is like a thing for you.
It is. We honeymooned in Rome and the Amalfi Coast. Mm. And I think that's the first time that we had eaten really, really good quality artisan pizza. And we came home and I remember on the airplane, we sat next to each other and we're saying, oh, let's start a restaurant and make really good pizza.
Aww.
And gelato. And we were like dreaming this big dream. So we came back and we decided not to start a restaurant, but to start working on how do we recreate the pizza we had in Italy. So that took us a long time. We've been honing our dough recipe for the last 11 years since we were honeymooning in Rome, and have learned a lot of tips along the way from some really expert pizza makers. We've kind of learned the art of simple. So Italian pizza is so simple and artful and beautiful in the way that they kind of curate the ingredients that go on the pizza. And so we've just been experimenting and just really trying to hone that art that is artisan pizza.
You put the art in artisan.
Right.
There you go. You can take that. What's your favorite all-time like pizza topping combo that you guys make at home?
I guess I would say margarita. I mean, it's kind of like saying vanilla. And I get mad when people say vanilla. I'm like, oh, really? Vanilla? No.
I love vanilla.
Okay, sorry. No, but I agree with you that a really good vanilla is so good. And you forget about that because you think that it's this really standard thing. And so I feel the same way about margarita pizza. It's such a standard combination of tomatoes, mozzarella, and basil, but it is just so perfectly delicious. Perfect. I just, yeah. that's like one of my, you know, when people ask, what would you eat on the last day of your life thing? I would eat a margarita pizza.
Wow. Wow. That's wonderful. That's great.
Cool. Sorry, we're going a little deeper there.
No, that was, we got really deep. That was a little morbid, but we're turning around. No, I'm just kidding. Okay. So I got to ask you guys, what are your favorite plants to eat individually? Favorite plant and Larson's favorite plant.
Well, I get a lot of heat for this, but I really love raw celery. So I'm going to have to go with celery.
Wow. I mean, there's not much you can even do with it. What do you do with it?
I just like it straight. It's like so refreshing and crunchy, and just it's like drinking water and eating celery.
Yeah. Well, Sonia, you burn more
Sonia
calories.
Does not agree with me.
I think it's so weird. It's like celery.
I mean, I've never heard anyone name it as their favorite. It's weird in general when someone even likes it, but I mean.
Especially get the like inside celery, you know, those like really tender parts. They're so good.
But what about when the strands get stuck in your teeth?
And then you don't have to floss.
It's built in floss.
Exactly.
Okay. That good. I love the honesty. We went from vanilla to celery. Love it. Okay, Sonia, what about you?
Okay. I love so many. The first thing I thought of was garlic. I know that's not really like the main thing you would eat, but right. We put it in almost everything. Just making vegetarian dishes, it's so nice to have that really savory flavor. So we put it in nearly everything that we make. Mm. And then my second was going to be, well, maybe a tie between sweet potatoes and Brussels sprouts. Yes. Oh, maybe and cauliflower.
Wait, now you're at four. I like you can't have four favorites.
I know.
That's okay.
But all of the, each one of those roasted are just so, so good.
Sweet potatoes, one of my top. One of my top for sure. What's Larson's favorite plant?
Blueberries.
Or banana. He loves bananas. He eats a lot of bananas.
Ugh, bananas are the best. As are blueberries. All plants are. Bottom line. What is your guys' favorite plant party restaurant? Or just, or pretty simple restaurant. Planty restaurant.
Oh, man. In all of the universe?
Maybe we could do near you since a lot of, you know, I know you liked some New York ones, but
yeah,
we have Getting right, Lowe's a lot.
I think. I mean, I really like here in Indianapolis, well, I'll list a couple since I can't really choose one ever. <That's> We were just at Napoli's, which is a really great pizzeria here in town, and they have really great salads too. Mm. So perfect for plant-based eating. And then the Garden Table is another restaurant here. There's a great location downtown Indianapolis and has a very kind of California vibe. There's a lot of plants going on. You can get an acai bowl, but you can also get meat, for the good old Indiana meat and potatoes crowd. So,
wow. In one restaurant, you can get an acai bowl and meat.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. There's a lot going on there.
That's cool. That's pleasing everyone. No one left behind. It's really cool that you guys had the chef of Balabusta on your podcast.
Oh, yeah.
That
yeah.
was a cool
she was
treat.
So great. And she's doing such great things for food. And just hearing her journey was really fabulous.
You have to go to her restaurant. You haven't been yet, right?
We haven't been. I really wanted to go last trip and it didn't work out. So next time let's go with you.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. That would be so great. The hummus. Oh my gosh. The food's amazing. Okay. I can't wait. It's a date.
All yes. right. Perfect.
Yay. Okay. Also, okay. What is your most used kitchen tool? You just got me all excited.
In all honesty, it's our kitchen knife, as Alex was mentioning earlier. We can't say enough about having a really sharp, really great knife in your kitchen. Other than that, probably, as Alex mentioned previously, a food processor, a blender. Mm-hmm. We do a lot of blended sauces or making hummuses and dips, so that kind of thing.
Yeah. What knife brand do you guys love?
We have a couple different brands. Shun, the really thin kind of Japanese style is nice. We both have one of those and those are probably our favorites.
Those are your faves. Cool. Are you guys smoothie people?
Not usually.
That's a good question. So we are actually really bad at making smoothies. We're trying to get better. It sounds really stupid, right? Like, how can you be bad at making a smoothie?
That's my thought. But, answer it.
But, yeah. But for some reason, we just like, you know, people say just throw stuff in a blender, but it's hard to get the right flavor and consistency.
Yeah,
you know, it'll be either too bitter or too sweet or too watery or too thick. So we're trying to get better at it. We have a couple smoothie recipes, and I know people laugh at smoothie recipes too, but actually it's really helpful to have, like, to remember how much of the liquid do you need? How much frozen fruit do you need? How much ice cubes do you need? So we've been working on that a little more lately.
That's funny. That is so funny that you guys, that's like a thing for you. A little struggle. I love it.
You can make sourdough. You just
I know. What? You make your own artisan pizza, but you can't make a green smoothie. No, that's awesome. That's so funny. Well, I know you're going to find some very user-friendly smoothie recipes in your home. I look forward to those.
We're working on that. And it actually is. It's a good tip for feeding kids. Larson loves anything that is smoothie in texture and consistency. And we actually have gotten, you know, those pouches that you can buy with kind of fruit and vegetable purees. Mm-hmm. There's actually pouches that you can buy to make things at home. So we actually have a recipe coming out tomorrow. Ooh. Speaking of recipes. So we're actually starting to make more and more kind of smoothie type recipes for Larson because he loves it. And he can't actually at this point in his life eat. He can't really eat raw kale, and raw vegetables are kind of hard for him to chew. But if you puree it up in a smoothie, he'll eat it right away.
So you're saying you can buy the empty pouches and put your own stuff in the pouches?
Right. Ooh. Yeah. So we do that and then just wash them out and reuse them.
How cool is that?
It's pretty slick.
Awesome. Well, I'll link that when it goes live in the show notes for people who want to make some pouches. Sounds like a good thing. So you've mentioned a couple books already, but what is a book or a couple books that have really inspired you guys in some awesome way? I know you've mentioned the Julia Childs. What's her first book called?
I think it was Mastering the Art of French Cooking. The one we had was, I'm going to forget. I think something in my kitchen, maybe.
A later book.
It was like the one.
Oh,
the
I see.
Yeah.
And Mark Bittman and Michael Pollan.
Right. So Food Matters by Mark Bittman, and then Food Rules by Michael Pollan, which is actually a really great book. Do you know it?
No.
So Food Rules is a short book. It's kind of like a coffee table book, but it's small. It's a paperback, and it has these food rules that Michael Pollan has kind of distilled. So his work, most of his work is very, you know, research-based and really heavy and really thick books. But this book is a short little paperback, and it has a bunch of rules. It might be like 100 rules. And he's gotten these rules from talking to a lot of people around the world about the way that they eat. Ooh. And just kind of like brought that into a more palatable way to talk about eating.
And they're a little bit sassy, like fuel your car at the gas station, but not yourself. Stuff like that.
Oh, yeah. Some toot in there.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, and there you go again with a double meaning. Because when you first said food rules, I was like, food rules. That was how I read it or heard it when you said it. But it sounds like it's both. So you guys are kindred souls.
Right. Exactly. Yes. We would love to meet him someday. He's a huge inspiration.
I hope you do. I bet you will. Make that happen.
Hope so.
Yeah. So where can everybody go to stay in touch with you? I mean, I could answer that, but I'll let you guys take it away. Where should people go?
Sure. So our website is acouplecooks.com, and we're also pretty active on Instagram. We're at acouplecooks, and same on Facebook and Twitter.
Perfect. And your podcast, which hopefully will be coming back soon.
Yes. yes. It will be coming back. It will be coming
back. Okay, good. Because it's wonderful. I love it.
And that's also called A Couple of Cooks.
Yes. Was that, I'm surprised it was so easy to, well, I guess you guys started so like a long time ago that no one had taken that yet. Because that's such a brilliant name. I'm surprised no one had come up with it.
Thanks.
But I guess you guys were the first.
Kind of we're kind of ancient.
Yes. You snagged it.
Every short time, we grab that right up.
There you go. That's awesome. Well, thank you guys so much for both coming on. This was too much fun, and I really, really appreciate it.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure to be here.
Thank you.
Thanks so much much for listening to the Party in My Plants podcast. I hope you're feeling like you are ready to slow down and embrace the art of pretty simple cooking. And maybe embrace the art of homemade Neapolitan pizza making. I'm sure after I get back from Italy, I will be all about that. Don't forget, mi amore, to check out the extensive show notes for this episode, plus so much more that takes the hell out of healthy eating over at partyinmyplants.com/139.